Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the out-of-control wildfires in California that have forced the evacuation of 13,000 from their homes as some 20 wildfires burn across the state. Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire, who is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University, joins us. The author of the forthcoming book, Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. He will discuss how these fires so early in the season indicate California and the West is facing a long, hot, and destructive fire season ahead. Then we will speak with James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues and the author of the bestsellers Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. We will discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11? And the evidence that makes it likely that 9/11 would have been stopped in its tracks if information the CIA and the NSA had at the time was shared and acted upon. Then finally, as the kingmaker Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, gets to decide who will make the cut to be in the top 10 on stage for the first Republican presidential primary debate in Cleveland on Thursday, we will examine how last-minute polling factors into who the lesser of the lessers will be. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, joins us to discuss how everyone in the crowded field is trying to position themselves to the right of each other, representing a party that today would consider Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan left-wing appeasers. And joining us now is Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University, and his forthcoming book is Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pine.
Thank you.
And much of California is ablaze, particularly in the north, and even here in Southern California in Los Angeles, we can look to the north and the sky is all brown with smoke from nearby fires, even here in the Southland. But there are about 13,000 people who have been urged to flee their residences in the area about 100 miles north of San Francisco. And there are more than 3,000 firefighters making a stand against these fires, which are pretty much out of control. And this is so early in the year. The fire season is not usually till the fall, or the late fall at that. But here we are in summer with 20 wildfires burning in California. So what's your understanding of why?
Well, first of all, this is an old California phenomenon. It's not new. It's taking on some new avatars, if you will. But the summer, you have a Mediterranean climate in much of the state. It's an ideal formula for fires. The north is early. But not exceptionally early. And, you know, you have these big fire busts up north. They're mostly by lightning, and they come in sort of saturated siege form. And in south, they're more, they cluster in different ways. And you're right, the worst of them tend to be with Santa Ana winds in the fall. But you have an ideal, California has an ideal climate for summer fires, too. So you've got it all, and you've had it for as far back as anyone can remember, and you'll probably have it as far forward as we can imagine.
Well, but this is not only California, though. Washington State and Oregon are also, first of all, they're feeling the effects of this drought and this summer heat, and they've had fires as well.
Well, that's certainly true, and you've had some unusual ones. Olympic National Park, essentially a temperate rainforest, only burns very rarely, and they had a nice fire. So we're certainly under exceptional conditions this summer. The drought is really making itself felt, and then all the usual stuff coming into play. But, you know, fire integrates a lot of things. It integrates everything around it. And you've got the fuels build up. You've got how we live on the land, how we organize the vegetation on the land. All of these other things are contributing as well.
Well, also how we encroach, suburbia encroaches into the forest, right? I mean, that's where most of these houses that are being burned are in this area, on the outskirts of cities and rural communities.
Well, that's exactly true, and that's been going on for some time now. Basically, I mean, my interpretation is that we're recolonizing what had been a rural landscape, but we're doing it with a kind of out-migration of urbanites. We're really creating little ex-urban enclaves scattered around the countryside, and that makes them vulnerable in particular ways, but it also reduces what had been a kind of buffer zone. The rural landscape had allowed some room for maneuvering. There's a lot less of that now as you begin filling up those spaces with little pockets of houses and hamlets.
Well, apparently there are some 6,900 homes being threatened. So those are not small numbers.
No, those are not. And it's hard to know. You know, we certainly hope that threatened doesn't mean burned. But we're seeing growing numbers of these decade by decade. And part of it is worsening environmental conditions, not just climate, but the whole fuel situation aggravated by forest health issues and insects, but also by the sheer number of houses being built. I mean, this is some of the most active construction in the country has been occurring in these sort of former rural sites.
Well, also, you know, there's a firefighter was also killed. So this is a serious 20 fires underway at the moment. I mean, as I say, you know, I noticed driving into the radio station today, looking to the north, how dirty the sky is. And it must be hideous up near where these fires are. And that's what I think you have to ask yourself is, you know, how does all of the fires themselves and the smoke, surely that also contributes to a lot of CO2, isn't it, in terms of global warming?
Yeah, and in fact, the air quality is a serious issue, particularly in places where, you know, where that smoke is going to drain and hold for a long time in the Central Valley. It really does create public health issues. And you're right, they're starting early enough on a large enough scale that California could be in for a very long and very savage fire season. We'll have to see. Right now, you've got most of the action in the country. Most of the burning occurred in Alaska earlier in the year. But it is serious. There are a lot of economic costs. There are ecological costs. And there are costs in lives as well.
And one of the excuses often cited by people that try to deny global warming is that we've had events in history in the past, climate changes, etc., spikes in climate. And while those claims are not accurate, they are often also used in terms of fires, that we've always had worse fires. So how do you, since you've done a history of fires, give us a sense of the proportionality here. Are we seeing bigger and more frequent fires?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a very tricky one because you're often comparing things that are quite different. Certainly, we're seeing a real uptick in the fire, in the number and severity of fires, large fires, compared to 50, even 60 years ago. But if you go back 100 years or 150 years, we have documentation. The country was a mess. It was filled with horrific fires, many of them far more damaging than what we're seeing now. And that was tied with the pattern of settlement in the West. For one thing, the country had a lot of fire. And some of it was bad fire, but a lot of it was just part of the background ecology. And people set lots of fires deliberately, and that was part of how they made that landscape habitable. In effect, they substituted tame fires for wildfires. So in some ways, what we're seeing is like a reemergent plague. It's like seeing smallpox or tuberculosis come back on a large scale. Hey, we thought we'd solve this problem. What happened? Well, conditions changed, and now some of those changing conditions, in fact, most of them are the result of our own actions, even the unhinging of climate. We are the keystone species for fire on the planet. And we decided we wanted to start burning lithic landscapes. We wanted to burn fossil fuels as well as living ones. And, you know, that has changed even the climate. So, yeah, in some ways, the critics are right. We've had larger fires, more damaging fires. I mean, whole communities wiped out in ways that we're not seeing presently. But they were the result of different sets of conditions, and so much of the present circumstance is really under our control, at least potentially, that I don't think that appeal to the past really is much of an excuse. We know how to keep houses from burning. We know what the factors are behind these conditions. We can't control all of them, but we can control a lot of them. And there's really no excuse to have this kind of recurring outbreak.
So when we see these fires on television and the news crews are all up there, and it's been the lead story now for several days on the nightly news on the networks, you always see these big tankers, aircraft, dropping all of this red fire retardant. I've heard some reports that stuff is kind of useless. What's your understanding of that?
Well, again, like most things, it's mixed. You know, people have been so conditioned to seeing those air tankers, and that is the marker that the officials, the authorities are taking action. They're doing everything they can. So they've become part of the ritual, whether they really contribute or not. And in fact, some of the cynics simply dismiss them as CNN drops now, because some of it, they have to do something for the news. They expect, that's what's expected. They certainly have their place, and they're much more effective at initial attack response than in when fires are large and going. Under really high winds, they're not going to be effective. You may not even be able to fly. So under extreme conditions, they break down. Well, that's really when you need, in some ways you need them the most. They're a mixed tool, and they can be misused. There are places where you don't want to drop that stuff, because in lakes or sensitive water courses, they can be toxic. So they don't put fires out, except maybe in really light grasses. You still have to put boots on the ground. You know, we've gotten conditioned, well, we can fight wars simply by bombing. And first of all, we're not at war with fire, I hope, because we'll lose if we are. But secondly, you're still going to have to. You really have to put people on the ground to really contain these fires.
So are you saying then, Stephen Pine, that there are better ways to deal with fires? My assumption would be that if you had a quick, ready reaction sort of ability to spot a fire before it grows and get the water and tankers and whatever resources you need to extinguish it early, because once it seems to reach a certain point, then maybe these tankers are just, as you say, just for CNN's benefit. They're really palliatives.
Well, the idea that, you know, you control fires by getting them where they're small is a very old one, and you know, it's in Shakespeare. A little fire is quickly trodden out, which being suffered rivers cannot quench. And that's certainly true in urban life, and that's where most of us live. We live in cities or suburbs. We live in places where that kind of free-burning fire is a problem. We don't want it. The best way, if you can't prevent it with some sort of codes, is to attack it absolutely as quickly as possible and contain it. And we've tried that strategy in wildlands and large countrysides, and it doesn't work. If there is any kind of natural basis for fire or any history of fire in the area, we know that it fails. What it means is that stuff just builds up, fuels, combustibles, you get bigger, more severe fires, you get into a race, and after a few decades, you're going to find yourself on the losing end. In a city, every fire put out is a problem solved, but in a wildland, every fire put out is a problem put off. So The issue is not the amount of burning. It's the character of the fires that we're seeing. In fact, we could probably be well served by having 5, 6 or more times as much burning going on in the country as we're seeing, but not in these kinds of fires. We need more controlled fires, prescribed fires. We need fires under other conditions that can do some of the ecological work, can quell some of these combustibles that are getting out of hand, and then, in effect, buffer against these really bad fires that we're seeing. Right now, we've got a system where the only fire we tolerate is the worst kind.
So, in other words, there could be scientific and well-protected ways to get rid of underbrush and in forest areas in the national and state parks on a more regular basis. I mean, I've heard occasions when these things get out of control, but I presume that they can be controlled, these control burns.
Sure. Well, there are always going to be some escapes, but, you know, we probably lose as many prescribed fires as we do wildfires. I mean, not all of our initial attacks succeed either, and they blow up. In certain parts of the country, Florida is the supreme example. Prescribed fire is really the foundation for fire management. And Florida will burn 2.5 to maybe 3 million acres a year. This is just Florida. So you can certainly do it when the conditions are favorable and, you know, political and social and cultural circumstances favor it. Over 50 years ago, we really began an effort. We recognized that the old effort to suppress all fires, the belief that we could exclude fire from the landscape, was misguided, and we needed to restore good fires. We took out good fires as well as bad fires. The effort to restore it got underway 50 years ago. And, half of the history, modern history of fire management in this country has been an effort put good fire back in. And we have really mixed outcomes. Some places have succeeded, most places have not. And in some ways, the failure of that fire revolution, if you will, has really set up many of the conditions for today. Climate aggravating it, of course, but we would still have a serious fire problem even if the climate stayed within historic ranges.
Well, Stephen Pine, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University, and his forthcoming book is Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about whether the NSA could have prevented 9/11.
Hose me down. I don't care, I'll burn out anyhow. It's for a lamb girl, nothing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and is also a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Well, thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
And your article's extraordinary, Jim, and it starts out with this plot that was uncovered by U.S. intelligence that an al-Qaeda affiliate in London had urged its supporters to send Clinton back in a coffin, referring to Bill Clinton's visit to Bangladesh, where they were going to fire a shoulder-launched missile to shoot down the president's chopper. Now, that obviously Clinton canceled that particular leg of his trip on the advice of intelligence. But what's so extraordinary is that same day, one of the hijackers of 9/11 down in San Diego called this number in Sana'a, Yemen, that the NSA had on top of its watch list, the Yemeni number 967-1200-578, apparently was at the pinnacle of their target list. But somehow they later said that they really didn't know who was making these calls. So I guess what I find extraordinary is not only is that extremely unlikely and been refuted, as you have in your article, by several people, James Bamford, what I find extraordinary is that Michael Hayden, the head of the NSA at the time, who later became the head of the CIA, he used that so-called gap in the intelligence as a way to justify the metadata program that later Snowden revealed. So I've never known how people can profit from their mistakes in this extraordinary way.
Well, it's interesting. Everybody that seems to have made a major screw up in 9/11 not only wasn't fired but was promoted. So this was probably the one of the largest screw ups you could imagine. That's the reason I decided to do this for Foreign Policy magazine, because they was coming out around the time of 9/11, and this is 14 years now, and these questions have never been answered. The key issue here was the fact that for years, not just briefly, but for years, the NSA was eavesdropping on this house in Yemen. It was the key house that bin Laden used as his operations center, since he couldn't conduct operations very easily out of the mountains of Afghanistan. Most of them were conducted in Yemen, and his communications center for Yemen was this house. And that was where a lot of the people that were involved with his operations would meet. So this was a house that the NSA had at the top of their target list. It was bin Laden's operations center. It was where the operations for the attack on the USS Cole, the attack on the USS embassies, and so forth took place. And it was where the planning for the 9/11 attack was taking place. So on the very day that bin Laden had... one of bin Laden's affiliates in London had called for the assassination of President Clinton. You had a member of the bin Laden team, one of the hijackers in San Diego, calling to the house the same day. And the NSA claims that not only did it miss that call, it missed all the other calls. He made at least... five or six other calls from San Diego to that house. And it seems incredible to anybody involved in technology that this mammoth agency that gets billions and billions and billions of dollars a year can have the most highly sought-after target that it's focused on and not be able to tell where a call is coming from. I mean, this is in the day of, the days when we have caller ID and when metadata has to precede a phone call, all phone calls, in order for telecom companies to be able to understand how to do the billing, how much to charge and who to charge and so forth. So that's why I decided to interview some of the former senior officials at NSA, and what they told me was that it's impossible, that that there was what they call ironclad coverage on that house. In other words, that house was the most highly eavesdropped on house in the world. They had 24-hour coverage on it. And they said it's always essential and it's always possible for the agency to find out where calls are coming from, especially when they've been listening to a house for years. I mean, I think it goes back to 1996. They first started targeting that house with eavesdropping. So, and by now it was 1999 when they first got the indication of 9/11. So that's, again, why I wrote the article, and I was hoping that at some point here the NSA would come up and explain this major discrepancy, why they missed 9/11 and why they're saying they missed it because they didn't have the technical capability to understand where a telephone call was coming from.
And you suggest that 9/11 could have been stopped in its tracks if they had shared this information.
Well, certainly, yeah, because if they found, as soon as the first two hijackers came into the country, and if the NSA had notified the FBI, the FBI would have begun an immediate program of eavesdropping on their communications, and it would have been totally legal because these people have been identified as associates of bin Laden living in the United States. So it would have been very easy to get a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrant, a FISA court warrant, to legally eavesdrop on their communications. And if they had been doing that, they would have picked up all the communications they had in San Diego with the other major players, Muhammad Atta and so forth, on the East Coast. And by listening to those communications and following these people and reading their emails and so forth, they would have certainly been able to see that there was a plot going on and stopped it long before we got to the final stages.
And again, I'm speaking with James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was a Washington investigative reporter for ABC World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and is also a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11? So, Jim, I've talked a few times to Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time of 9/11, and he's also the co-chairman of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And he finds it extraordinary that Midar, the character that we're talking about, who was down in San Diego.
Khalid al-Midar.
Yes, right. Yeah, and his partner, first of all.
Nawaf al-Hazmi.
Right. These two guys were subject of Malaysian intelligence. There was the famous terrorist summit in Malaysia, which Malaysian intelligence monitored. They didn't video, but they audioed. And then the CIA tracked these guys, but they lost them at the airport in Bangkok. And then they show up later in Los Angeles. And they have an extraordinary coincidental meeting at a restaurant with a Saudi intelligence operative who's over here in the United States monitoring Saudi students and a person from the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles who happened to run into these two guys. They set them up in this house down in San Diego. My understanding is that not just the NSA knew about these people, but also that the CIA did, and the fact the person that did know about them and didn't share that information with the FBI was the person who was the subject of that movie, Zero Dark Thirty, about the killing of bin Laden. So what's going on here? There's just too much smoke around these two guys that you can't deny that there's a huge cover-up going on.
Well, the other irony is the fact that the house they ended up moving in, the house that they ended up getting an apartment in, one of the bedrooms in the house, was owned by a person who was an FBI informant. So there's a lot of coincidences that are taking place here. The key thing, the two, beyond the whatever those documents have to say, which I haven't seen either, and I do hope that they'll come out, but the other major screw-up was the fact that when Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi went from Yemen, the other one from Pakistan, to Kuala Lumpur. Khalid al-Midar went through Dubai, and the CIA had asked the Dubai government to secretly photograph the passport, and they did. And when they sent it to the, al-Midar was going on his way to Kuala Lumpur. And when they sent the images of the passport to the CIA station and also CIA headquarters, it was extraordinary because the passport contained a fairly recent active visa to the United States, which meant, obviously, these people were coming to the United States. Now, one of the two FBI agents in the in what was known as Alex Station, that was the CIA's Bin Laden unit, had been an old friend of mine, Mark Rossini. He was one of the two FBI agents in there, and he's told me numerous times that they wanted very much to send a message to FBI headquarters saying, these guys have U.S. visas and they're heading to the United States. And he and his partner drafted a memo to the FBI headquarters telling him this. And then it was denied, they were denied authority to send it by the CIA people in Alex Station. And again, it's never been explained why. Those people have never been reprimanded for not allowing U.S. law enforcement to know that terrorists are heading to the United States. Matter of fact, they were all promoted. So again, this is the biggest event that's happened in probably, you know, since World War II, and yet we're not allowed to know why these screw-ups took place or why they're being covered up.
And the Alex Station, of course, one of the people at Alex Station was Mike Scheuer, who I've interviewed a number of times, and you have too, James Bamford. He revealed, did he not, that the NSA wouldn't share with the CIA the information that was coming from these wiretaps into this headquarters of Bin Laden's operation in Sana'a, Yemen, where all of these 9/11 hijackers were checking in, that the CIA then went ahead and set up their own interception satellite dish, but it apparently only was able to get half of the calls. I'm not sure which half of the calls it got. So walk us through that.
Well, that was another extraordinary thing. When I interviewed Mike Scheuer, again, as you mentioned, he was the head of the of Alex Station, which was a unit at CIA charged with tracking Bin Laden. And he knew because NSA told him that they were actively monitoring the house in Yemen, Bin Laden's operational center. So he asked NSA for copies of the raw data coming out of the house, not just a weekly summary. And they refused. He asked three times, and each time they refused to allow him to get access to this communication, these communications. So eventually the CIA had to build their own listening post. They built a dish out someplace in the Indian Ocean or someplace in the area where they could catch the satellite beam going down to Sana'a, Yemen. And they were able to pick up parts of the conversation, but they weren't able to pick up the other half. I mean, part of it goes up to a satellite, and unless you have a satellite up there, you're not able to catch a lot of it. So, I mean, it's a very complex thing. That's why NSA has so much technology. So with the limited technology that the CIA had, they were only able to get half the conversations, and then they went back to NSA and asked NSA if they could finally give them the other halves of the conversation so they could make sense of it. And the CIA refused. They constantly refused to do that.
So this, of course, this question arises of whether this was mendacity or incompetence. And, of course, conspiracy theorists have seized on the possibility of mendacity, that somehow the NSA knew about all of this, these plans, and they deliberately kept everybody in the dark for, I guess, to save George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's failing presidency. I mean, that seems to be the assumption in the 9/11 truthers' conspiracy theories. So what's your sense, though, in terms of mendacity versus incompetence? What would the motive be for not sharing this information? Were they basically waiting to get better information, even though they had pretty damn good information that something was about to happen? Is it turf battle? What explains?
No, it was turf, basically. Again, I've written about the NSA for decades. I've done three books on the NSA, and I've followed the NSA's history. And in looking at the NSA's history, right from the very beginning, there was always this competition, this jealousy, this sort of animosity between NSA and CIA, because the NSA has this secret charter when it was created, and it said that only NSA has the power to, or the jurisdiction, however you want to say it, to analyze its own intercepts, its own to break the codes and to analyze the information, whatever it intercepts. NSA has the sole, it's what they call the sole executive agent for doing that. So anytime any other agency, not just now, or not just 9/11 rather, but all the time before that, anytime any other agency wanted raw data from NSA, in other words, the raw transcripts, the raw intercepts as opposed to a summary at some point, they were turned down. And so in the days leading up to 9/11, of course nobody knew 9/11 was going to happen, the NSA just did what it always did. It says, no, you can't have raw data. I mean, that's our charter. It's in our charter. We're the only ones who have raw data. We issue reports, but we're the only ones that have raw data. So that's sort of the way it worked. It's sort of the way the NSA always operated, and they continued to operate that way in the days leading up to 9/11, and that's why the CIA was always turned down.
Well, but at the time, George Tenet was the DCI, which means Director of Central Intelligence. He's supposed to be a Central Intelligence. It's not just the CIA. It's all the intelligence agencies. He goes over to Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, on a number of occasions and keeps saying that bin Laden is determined to attack in the United States. And so did Kofa Black. So they were rattling Condoleezza Rice's cage, and she sort of offhandedly blew them off, because the attitude inside the Bush White House was that any warnings coming from the Clintons, which, you know, Clinton passed off all these warnings about bin Laden being a serial killer and determined to come and strike again, they ignored them. It was known as ABC, anything but Clinton. So in that climate, how do you explain the fact that if the DCI is convinced that bin Laden's coming at the United States, why was the NSA not alerted, and why wasn't a high priority put on this information that they already had in-house, because they were tapping the headquarters of where the plots were being planned in Yemen?
Well, not only that, I mean, probably one of the biggest ironies in the entire 9/11 is the fact that when the hijackers, the ones from San Diego, moved to the East Coast to get prepared to take down the Pentagon, to get the planes to crash into the Pentagon, they were looking for a place to set up their headquarters for the 6 weeks or so before the attack. And the place they decided to set it up was a motel in a town in Maryland called Laurel, Maryland. Well, Laurel, Maryland is the company town for NSA. NSA is the major employer in Laurel, Maryland. So they were only about 2 miles away from NSA headquarters. So you have the NSA headquarters there, which is supposed to be looking for all these terrorists, and you have the hijackers at a motel just a few miles away, and they're going to the same restaurants, the same exercise gyms, and so forth. So that's how bad it was. Now, the problem was that NSA feels that it has the authority to turn down any agency that's requesting those documents. I've seen it numerous times leading up to 9/11. And Tenet, I don't think, just didn't put enough pressure on NSA. From what I understood from Scheuer, Tenet never approached NSA about those documents. Those are questions that should be asked of George Tenet and Condoleezza Rice.
Well, but if Tenet felt that he was alarmed, and apparently so was Kofa Black, thinking that they believed an attack was coming, wouldn't they, as colleagues, him and Hayden, just even informally said, By the way, Mike, you know, I'm really staying up at night worried about Al-Qaeda attacking us, you know, so you guys better keep a watch out. I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Well, not only that, he never bothered to presumably he knew about the hijackers coming into the U.S. A year before. Beginning a year before, and because that was it was picked up, you know, like I said, they had as of January 2000, they had indications that these guys were coming because the CIA got copies of the visas. So the CIA had known this since January 2000, and Tenet never bothered to inform the FBI or anybody else about it. So so all these are questions that I, you know, I've always had, and I have no answers to them. I don't speculate because that's somebody else's department. All I do is I'm a reporter, so I report what I find, and it's sure. Sort of an endless circle to get into the whole spend days speculating why people do things. I have no idea. I'm just all my job is to report what happens and so forth. I've tried to avoid being a speculating about all these things because it's an endless game.
Well, we can only hope that Senator Graham has been joined by Senator Rand Paul in trying to get these 28 pages declassified from the Joint Congressional Committee report into the 9/11 terrorist attacks, that apparently those who've read them are alarmed by the extent to which they reveal Saudi involvement in 9/11. So I guess stay tuned and keep at it, Jim.
Well, I don't think there should be any. It's like the Kennedy assassination. I don't think there should be any classified documents anywhere, anytime, regarding incidents of that importance. And so, yes, I'm all in favor of Senator Graham on his quest to get those documents revealed, and I'm equally interested in getting NSA to answer those questions I posed in my foreign policy article about why they claimed they didn't know that this was happening, and number two, how they can justify saying that they didn't have the technology to know where a telephone call was coming from.
Well, James Bamford, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and is also a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11? We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into who is going to make the cut in Thursday's first Republican presidential debate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And there's a great deal of expectation for the first Republican presidential debate on Thursday night in Cleveland, which Fox News is going to present. And, of course, this is a huge boost for Roger Ailes. He's something of a Republican kingmaker to begin with, and as is his boss, Rupert Murdoch. But in this case, he really does appear to be the kingmaker in terms of who makes the cut, because they've drawn a threshold of the top 10 Republicans according to polls, but nobody quite knows which polls we're talking about. And I assume at the end of the day, they'll probably go with the Fox News poll. Would that be your guess?
Well, they're claiming to use a variety of national polls. In the end, all of these are decisions, as you point out, made by Roger Ailes. And I don't think he's going to be taking critical questions afterwards. So what they do is, I think, going to be motivated by their desire to shape the presidential field more than anything else.
Well, if you go by the current polls, and I think the deadline is 5 p.m. on Thursday, the cutoff point varies in terms of who the 10th person is. With the latest CBS poll, it's Bobby Jindal is Rick Perry are both at 2%. So that's where that one stands. And then the Bloomberg poll, it's between Kasich and Rick Perry. And then the Fox poll, it's between Christie and John Kasich. And then I guess the other one, Monmouth University poll, it's between Kasich and Fiorino. So they're sort of all over the place here, these polls, just as I'm going through them.
Right. And of course, most of these candidates are not candidates in any meaningful sense. You know, it's not unusual for senators, governors, other people to run to increase their visibility politically. Sometimes people run to try and leverage it for a cabinet position. You know, people have all sorts of reasons for running for president, knowing they will never win. If I were a Republican, I would want to see this field winnowed down pretty quickly. Some of the folks are just plain embarrassing. Lindsey Graham, Bobby Jindal. I would, if I were a Republican, I would shudder to think of Bobby Jindal in the, you know, the national spotlight for very long. He fumbles almost every opportunity he gets. You know, some others like Rick Perry have been down this road before and embarrassed themselves. If I was a Republican, I'd want to push him out of the race as quickly as possible. You know, we're going to end up probably with Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio. Ted Cruz is a wild card. He's an extremely effective speaker and charismatic and has a rabid base. He might be in the mix later. John Kasich is an interesting guy. He's, you know, governor of a large state. Who knows if he can pull up, but most of the rest of these people really aren't players. And then the only other person left to talk about, of course, is Donald Trump, and he's not really a candidate either. He's engaged in his own media circus that stars Donald Trump, but it's not really a campaign in any meaningful sense.
Well, if we were to go with the Fox News poll, since Fox is going to make the decision, and it's all up to Roger Ailes, has Donald Trump at 26%, first place, followed by Jeb Bush at 15%, Scott Walker at 9%, Ben Carson at 7%, Ted Cruz at 6%, Mike Huckabee at 6%, Marco Rubio at 5%, Rand Paul at 5%, and then it's a tie between Chris Christie and John Kasich as to who of those two would end up in the top 10. That is, I mean, first of all, where does this guy, Ben Carson, come from? I mean, what the hell's going on there? Why is he
well,
even
you know,
in this?
Well, you know, he's a successful doctor who had some public visibility for his medical work. He made a name for himself as kind of a motivational speaker. He's African-American, and those are rare in the Republican Party at any high level. Apparently, he's a very charismatic guy and attracts crowds. It's unlikely he's a serious candidate. Of the list, you know, I apologize for having forgotten Scott Walker, but, you know, when there are 17 candidates, it's hard to keep them all in mind. You know, I said that Bush, Rubio, possibly Cruz are players, and of course, Scott Walker also. And that reminds us that this is not just about charisma and the ability to attract attention through media. It's also about money. And Scott Walker has a lot of the right-wing libertarian money behind him. His, of course, great claim to fame is that in a traditionally Democratic state, that is Wisconsin, he was able to bust the public employees union and, you know, slash the budget and do all these sorts of things. And in the Republican Party, those are all big pluses. So, you know, again, I think we're talking about four, maybe at the most five people who are viable. And it's just a question of how long the others can raise enough money to stay on the campaign trail before they fall off. That, I think, is the most likely possibility here. How many months that will take, I don't know. Fox News will have a lot to do with it, because not only are they, of course, sponsoring this debate, but they make decisions about who gets on the news every night. And since Fox News is the de facto network of the Republican Party, those daily decisions made in the newsroom are just as important as the decision about who's in the debate.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. And we're talking about who's going to make the cut in Thursday night's Fox News debate, the first debate of the Republican presidential candidates. Obviously a crowded field, and the top 10 have to be winnowed out. And it seems that throughout most of these polls that I've been looking at here, Robert, the bottom is usually, well, at the very bottom is Pataki, then you've got Gilmore, who is pretty much invisible, Lindsey Graham, Bobby Jindal, Carly Farino, and Rick Santorum. Now, they get their own debate, I understand, an hour before. Is that how it's going to be?
Yeah, they're kind of colloquially referring to that as the kids' table. Of course, that will have far fewer viewers, and just being put into the second tier, you know, being seated at the kids' table tells everybody you're not a serious contender. But those names you just listed have, you know, virtually no chance of, not only no chance of the nomination, but they have no chance of gathering the money necessary to continue on the campaign. Again, I'm not a psychologist, and if I were a psychologist, I'm not sure I'd venture a guess what motivates people. Sometimes it's ego, as I said, sometimes it's leveraging it for other political purposes. But it's at this point, people are using terms like sideshow, circus. You know, it's hard to actually find an appropriate term for a political system that is not merely entertainment, but it's embarrassing entertainment. It's the kind of entertainment that decent people cringe at, and yet that's our political system right now. So the whatever we think about the Republican Party, part of this is just a reminder that we do not have a meaningful electoral system, at least not at this level. Now, you know, in local elections, sometimes real issues get debated and people really engage with voters. But at the national level, I think it's just always important to say we do not have a meaningful electoral system. That means that elections really aren't about ideas, and they're not really about people. They're about media and money. They're about who can attract the money to stay in the race and who can either buy or get free media to you know, spread a message. And the message isn't going to be about policy. It's not going to be about ideas. The message is going to be tailored by some advertising and PR firm, much like you would get commercial products advertised. Now, that's a banal observation. People have been saying this for a long time. There's hardly anything original in that. But I think the degree to which nobody thinks national elections are really serious anymore is quite stunning for what we like to call the world's oldest democracy. After all, we're supposed to be setting the agenda for the rest of the world, and thank God the world is not taking our lead.
Well, I hope the world is not watching these debates. They'd be alarmed, wouldn't they?
Well, you know, I think
truly,
when I travel abroad or talk to journalists from other countries, there's nothing new in this. Again, people around the world are well aware of what a charade the American electoral system is at this level. I think that the election of Obama, the fact that, you know, the United States, with its history and contemporary practice of white supremacy, the fact that we elected an African-American president did sort of put a shine on the American system for 8 years. And I think around the world, people maybe, as far as I could tell, you know, had a little bit of hope that we were, you know, becoming a civilized country. But I think this throws it right back to where, really where we were when George Bush was president, where the world sees the United States as hypocritical, as a great power in decline, a kind of giant thrashing around trying to protect its turf, and meanwhile, captured in a political system that makes a farce of democracy.
But what seems to be happening to the Republican Party is that you wouldn't think it could get further to the right, but it is. Yeah. It keeps going further to the right.
It's really quite striking. I'm, you know, 57 years old, so I came of age politically in the 1970s when there were, you know, what we used to call Rockefeller Republicans, moderate Republicans, Northeastern Republicans who were, you know, fiscal conservatives, as the phrase is often used, but fairly moderate in terms of, you know, social policy and, you know, in some sense, even in world affairs. Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York, made a bid for president, didn't make it. But those kind of folks were common, and they're gone now from the Republican Party, or at least they're gone from high office. And so if you look at all 17 of those Republicans, as you point out, what's striking is how far to the right they are. We sometimes forget it because it's kind of a gradual thing, but the political spectrum in the United States has moved dramatically to the right. And that's compared to any other, you know, industrial, technological society. Now, of course, Europe also has right-wing parties. There's been a rise of some of the nativist anti-immigration parties, in the far-right parties in Europe. But they're considered on the margins, even when they vie for, you know, elections. They're marginal, in a sense. Here, we're talking about one of the two major parties, the Republican Party, which now spawns candidates from the kind of hard right to the crypto-fascist right to the crazy right-wing populist. I mean, I don't even know how to describe some of these people. And that's dangerous. Another thing to remember, of course, is the Republican Party is essentially an all-white party. I mean, obviously there are non-white members and even elected officials, but the Republican Party is a white people's party, and I don't think that's impolite to say. I think it's just, you know, honest. It's a party increasingly representing not just the wealthy, but the ultra-rich, not just the 1%, but the 0.1%. We now have campaign laws that make that even easier. All of these are problems in the Democratic side, too. The Democratic Party has been pushed to the right over the last three decades or so. Bill Clinton's election signaled that that was the direction the party was going. The Democratic Party is captured by big money as well. I don't want to be naive about this. But the Republican Party, in some ways, is, I don't even think of it as a normal political party. It's a collection of insurgent forces and entrenched wealth. And it's hard to know how to describe it. The only thing we can know for sure is we should be scared of it, I think.
Well, Robert Jensen, I thank you very much for joining us.
Great. I was happy to check in from Texas with the crazy quotient from my state.
Well, and we always appreciate it. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Construct Dialogue. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.